This is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance. I'm delighted to be again with Ellen Levy. Those of you listening, there's a first podcast you might want to check out, and we're going to continue the conversation here. So, Ellen, maybe you could introduce yourself again briefly, and we'll try and pick up the conversation.
I'm an artist and educator, and I live in New York. I'm glad that I was past president of the College Art Association, and I am now an advisor for IDSVA, which is one of around 14 places offering artists PhDs, and I teach consciousness and creativity at the New School. And I'm very glad to have a second chance at this because Roger had the last word, and I never got a chance to give mine.
And my last word was that this was the first time I've ever heard an artist tell the advantages of reductionism.
Well, these are definitely fighting words, but actually it's true. It's just when other methods come along, they don't necessarily obviate things before. Newtonian science is still valid and it can be used in certain situations. And the reality is that a debate was staged on this point at Columbia about 4 years ago, which was fascinating because it was a real hypothetical. The hypothetical is if you only had limited funding of several billion dollars to give for brain research, would you go with a connectome like Seung has written about, or would you go with a more traditional approach of dissecting, in the case of Eric Kandel, aplysia, and finding where those connections go? The danger, obviously, in the all-over global viewpoint is that you have telephone lines without knowing who they belong to or where they go.
Right. That was the analogy I used earlier, which is I'm working with a neurobiologist, Gagan Wig, here at UT Dallas, and he's working on a connectome data. And, you know, he's mapping hundreds of thousands of these connections in the brain for 20-year-old people and 60-year-old people and so on. And my analogy was, if you took the city of Dallas and all you had was the sewage maps and the water pipe maps, could you tell how Dallas was going to vote in the next election? And, you know, that's a stretch. Although a colleague of mine said, actually, you could, because dense cities tend to vote to the left, and spread out cities tend to vote to the right, and so maybe the nature of the network could actually indicate political leanings.
Correlation, however, not causation.
Causation, yeah, absolutely. One of the things we didn't talk about is you're teaching consciousness. How does one teach consciousness?
With great difficulty. My starting point was John Searle, which is not a bad one, yeah, with his articles from years ago in the New York Review of Books. But one thing seems to be clear. We don't have our fingers on this, and certainly there's no proof, but attention seems to be key to all of this. What you don't pay attention to essentially does not exist for you.
Okay, that's really interesting. That's a real coincidence. So one of the projects we're working on with this neuroscientist is with the fMRI data they have, and one of the things we're doing is we're sonifying the data, turning some of the data into sound, and we use this vocabulary of technology of attention. So the question is, which part of the data should you pay attention to? And, you know, you and I are talking to each other, we're listening to each other, we're watching each other, and we have absolutely no problem switching our attention between a visual dominant to a sound dominant to a tactile dominant interpretation. And if, you know, if we heard a fly buzzing in between us, immediately we'd pay attention to what that noise was. And so I agree with you that a lot of, the interesting things in the area of what you're calling consciousness is indeed, given this deluge of data that the brain is getting all the time,
but
how does it know what to pay attention to?
But actually, a lot is known at this point about attention, not about consciousness, but we do know there's top-down and bottom-up attention. You do know that it plays a role in what the mind sees as reality. All of us probably are familiar with Gorillas in Our Midst, which was an experiment where people were asked to count the number of basketball teams that did something, that were able to score, and they failed to notice the gorilla that came through the space. I also staged something like this for an art experiment where I had 10 objects that were recognized to have been stolen, looted during the Iraq War in 2003, disappear one by one while people are playing three-card Monty, uh-huh. which is a con game. And even as soon as you give a task, count the number of Queen of Hearts, as soon as you give that task, that's where the attention goes. But the reason I think that artists are so valuable right now to neuroscientists is that many are masters of manipulating and guiding attention, like Randy the Magician.
So some of the, that's kind of interesting. And as we chatted before, I think both of us are uncomfortable with the area that some call, sometimes called neuroaesthetics, which is a particular slice of thinking about the problem. Now, there's no doubt that understanding those mechanisms is something that's good to understand, but how that really informs the kind of questions you're talking about is less clear.
Well, for example, I heard Susana Martinez Conde, a neuroscientist who wrote a book with her husband on magic and illusion. They're both neuroscientists. Worked with a very famous pickpocket. And what they ended up realizing was that as a distraction, an arm that makes a slight curve is far more effective in distraction than one that goes in a straight line. This was not something they had noticed before.
In fact, already you've sort of started answering one of the questions I had, which is, you know, this whole question about the growing nexus between the neurosciences, art, and performance, how is that informing your own practice? And then you just gave an example of an artwork you did where clearly you were manipulating human perception. Now, in a culturally loaded way, obviously looted artifacts from Iraq is a different thing than a gorilla walking through the... but clearly it's informing your own artistic practice.
Well, it is, and it's also commenting on various theories of perception, because I, even more than that, and I did record people's gaze and what they noticed, what they said they noticed. And for me, the question was whether I could shift a background, something that was in the background and invisible, to a point where it was totally visible. And I found, by the way, in people I interviewed, that there was a select group that could see both background and foreground at the same time and keep them all together. And they were people, for the most part, that had training in art, in the arts. One was a student from Juilliard, and they attributed that ability to that.
Okay, I'm going to throw a little bit of a loop into the conversation, if that's okay.
That, sure.
You know, that dialogue is a dialogue. One of the people that I started reading again recently, and you may not know him, is a mathematician called Ralph Abraham, who was actually very active in some of the early days of complex network science and so on. And he wrote a recent article on mathematics and spirituality, where he talks about how his mathematical practice has been informed by his meditation practice, his drug-taking habits. and, you know, he believes actually that those practices help him manipulate his own perception in a way that he can see things that his normal self cannot see.
Well, I'm surprised that you're doubting that this plays a factor, because we were just off air having the conversation about embodied cognition.
Yeah.
So for him, the embodied had to do with these alternate states to some extent.
Yeah, and I guess the problem that I have with that is, you know, like everybody of our generation, I've done a fair number of drugs, and I always viewed these as things that deregulated my perception rather than fine-tuned my perception. And it just strikes me that, you know, it's amazing to me that the brain is able to develop any kind of meaningful, stable interpretation of what's going on. And so I think, now, obviously meditation practices is very different than DMT that introduces psychochemicals and so on. But I guess I'm just skeptical. But I think your answer on embodied cognition has answered me. So,
well, I think, again, from the art point of view, many artists are involved with disorienting procedures,
mm-hmm.
as a way to understand the world.
And to reframe the world. So, you know, I would accept that. And clearly, you know, that suddenly gets us into an area that we were chatting about before, which is the centrality of emotions in this discussion, which often is sort of off limits for scientific inquiry.
But actually has, as we both know, undergone a sea change, where you have people like Panksepp and Ledoux and Damasio who've been able to quantify it.
Yeah. And clearly, you know, that's the domain where artists feel very comfortable, given that they're trying to give experiences to people that are emotionally loaded in some way.
Not only this, but there's also much more art where the medium is the mind. I also think, and you might, I don't know how much time we have, but there are really amazing performance took place by Alora and Calzadilla, who were the U.S. people who were in the Venice Biennale several years ago. What they did is they had a prepared piano so that the inside was missing, part of it. They placed Juilliard students in the center so that they were playing Beethoven upside down and inside out.
Mm-hmm.
And also on a piano on wheels that was causing the piano to move almost constantly. What all this meant is that there was no such thing as muscle memory that was operative for the pianist. And there was a certain amount of fidgeting and groping that upset the equilibrium, both of the audience and players.
Okay, very good. Well, we're going to have to wrap this up again. We could talk for hours, I suspect, here. And I totally agree with you that there's something very interesting going on right now in the art science community on this nexus between the neurosciences, the cognitive sciences, and the work of contemporary artists. And so exciting times.
Thank you for having me on this.
Thank you, Ellen. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.